G'day. This is Ray Powell. I am a former military officer, director of Sea Light, and this is the pilot episode of Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? This is where my co-host, Jim Caruso, and I dig into the question of, we've got this big region of the world that we keep trying to pivot to, and yet somehow other things keep happening. But why should we care? Why should people pay attention to the Indo-Pacific of all the other things that are going on in the world? So Jim, former diplomat, my former boss, a very benevolent and wise boss, I should note, why is it that with all of the things going on in the world, a hot war in Europe, a hot war in the Middle East, why should people care about the Indo-Pacific?
It's a hell of a question, Ray. There are hot wars, as you said, in Europe. There is so much going on in the world that it's hard to keep track of it all. And now you and I are saying people should care about the Indo-Pacific. I think the first thing is people will say, well, what is the Indo-Pacific? So I think the way we're trying to define it is everything from India all the way to the west coast of the U.S. So it's about half the world right there, more or less, or as they say in the Indo-Pacific Command, everything from Hollywood to Bollywood. It's a lot of area. So just the geographic scope of that part of the planet means, yeah, maybe we have to care about something as large as that in our world. Secondly, it's not just large physically. The population of the world is such that almost half of the people who exist, of the 8 billion people or so in the world, almost 4 billion are in this area. So you might want to care about what 4 billion people are up to and how it may affect us here at home. And finally, it's not just big in terms of population, it's big in terms of global economy. China, by most accounts, is the second largest economy in the world. Japan is third. We have other countries like the countries of ASEAN. We have Australia. And of course, we have India. So altogether, they make up a huge portion of U.S. trade and investment. It makes a huge portion of the global economy. And what they do, as we found from the supply chain problems, from the pandemic, what happens there inevitably impacts us here. You can't ignore it. It won't just go away by closing your eyes. It's there, and we can either try to engage with it and shape it or hope for the best.
Well, Jim, I noticed that you got through basically that entire discussion while talking about all the things that were not the military reasons, and I guess you're leaving that one to me. So I'll go ahead and put on my patent helmet and talk about military concerns in the Indo-Pacific. And I think we have to start with the fact that we are in a competition with the rising China, and we are very concerned that any kind of escalation to armed conflict with China could present really an existential threat to the United States. And I mean, I think we just really have to be honest and say, boy, I mean, that could really go pear-shaped in a big hurry if we don't correctly manage it. So, you know, I look at things that, you know, China has said, whether it be its determination to consolidate control of the South China Sea within its huge nine-dash line claim, or its stated determination to absorb Taiwan. And the U.S. has treaty alliances in the South China Sea, of course, especially with the Philippines, and then going north to Japan and Korea. But it also has public law that says that we're committed to the defense of Taiwan. So I look at that and I say, you know, yes, I get that there is war in Europe. I get that there is war in the Middle East. Those are extremely serious and consequential developments. But war in the Pacific, that's to me, if I have to think of something that keeps me up at night, it falls right there.
So how does it compare to the lead up to World War II and Japan's efforts to basically do what China is doing now, which is create an economic sphere of influence and control?
Yeah, actually, I mean, there are very, very troubling parallels. There's no such thing as a perfect analogy. And there are differences. But, China looks at its near abroad and it sees vulnerabilities and it sees a lot of the United States. It sees, again, U.S. allies. It sees U.S. Military forces, which have been in the South and East China Sea for a very long time. But increasingly, it sees those as direct threats. And so it bases its responses in many cases on the fact that it's got these U.S. military assets floating around off of its shores. And China, of course, is free to do the same thing, but it's an awfully long way to go from, you know, the coast of China all the way to, say, California or Alaska, simply to sort of mark your presence. And there's a lot less there off of our coast than there is off of China's coast. And I think that they are sort of, they're concerned about that. They worry about that. They feel hemmed in. So, you know, when we think about how we looked at China's threat perceptions, I think that's important when we're dealing with, you know, how do we sort of exhibit strategic empathy, or at least understand how China, you know, looks at the world. We have to start with the fact that they look at themselves as surrounded. They look at the United States as having these two immense oceans that set us apart from all of our potential adversaries. And they look at themselves as just sort of being surrounded by potential adversaries. But, you know, I do think we do have to kind of go back to the fact that there is a lot more to this relationship than, you know, military necessity and deterrence. There is a very intertwined, integrated global economy of which both the United States and China are a part. And Jim, I mean, when I look around the region, I'm looking at opinion polls and things like this. I see a lot of ambivalence about this competition and you know, whether we're causing all of these countries to into choices that they don't want to have to make.
Well, from all the time I spent in Southeast Asia, even Australia, when I first got there in 2016, it was always, don't make us choose between our security and our economy, over and over. Don't make us do it. And the fact is, China is the largest trade partner for basically every country. Now, most of these countries have huge trade deficits with China, but China also absorbs a whole bunch of their exports. These countries don't know what would replace China as a market. I would note that when China started putting a bunch of tariffs on Australia to try and coerce Australia to change its policies towards China, Australia quickly found some new export markets, including among a lot of the countries that are making this argument that we're too dependent on China. And that seems to me, the answer is yes, absolutely, trade with China. Take China's investment as long as it's transparent and adds to your economy. But don't be dependent on China. When I was a banker many, many moons ago, one thing you always said was, look at the client, the borrower, and see if they're dependent on one client for the majority of their business. Because if it is, then you know they are really, really in a dangerous position. So I would encourage all these economies to say, yes, China's important, it's a big economy, it'll always be important, but for God's sakes, diversify.
And, you know, Jim, I'm really interested in this because, you know, I, as long as we served together, of course, in Australia, and every visitor came and said the same thing, every U.S. visitor, we don't want to make you choose. We're not trying to force you to choose. And yet, of course, this perception is out there everywhere. What other choices do these economies have? If you're a country that has a huge stake in having China buy your exports, where are the other options?
Well, I think it's hard to find options for, especially for the commodities that China sucks in so assiduously, so they can transform those commodities into the things we buy, like solar panels and EVs these days. But the answer, it seems to me, is to work together. Don't let yourself be coerced into the divide and conquer approach, especially among the ASEAN countries. If China starts trying to coerce, say, the Philippines economically by not buying their bananas as they tried a while ago, it seems to me the ASEAN countries have to stand together and either buy the Philippine bananas themselves or tell China, look, you can't do this to one of our members. You guys are supposed to keep saying you want a peaceful region. This isn't peaceful. So I would really encourage ASEAN to stick more together, for them to cooperate more on economic efforts to make themselves more resilient, and to work with Western partners to say, you know, you guys want to be our partners? Well, here's how you can help. That'd be good.
You know, you used a couple of terms in the same sentence that I'm not used to hearing together these days, which is ASEAN and work together. You know, it seems like actually, and I read the Global Times, so you don't have to. There's a lot of messaging coming out of Beijing, trying to drive a wedge into ASEAN, basically saying, look at all of these smart countries who are working with us and where they've got these bilateral visits. And meanwhile, we have, you know, this one country, the Philippines, which is, you know, foolishly trying to pick a fight with China. It seems to me, Jim, that, you know, that this whole idea of ASEAN centrality is constantly sort of running up against the fact that these are just really different countries in ASEAN. And they have, you know, they have very different backgrounds. They have different ties. And they perceive themselves to have very different economic and security interests. Is that the way you see it?
Well, look, ASEAN is one of those things sort of like the UN. If it didn't exist, you'd have to invent it. But that doesn't mean it's perfect. You have to think back also to the time ASEAN was formed. It was formed to create peaceful cooperation between countries that were in competition, sometimes violent competition, as between Malaysia and Indonesia in the late 60s. And it has worked as far as relations between ASEAN countries and keeping the peace has been incredibly successful. They've created a more or less free trade area among themselves. They try and coordinate different policies, for instance, with the coup regime in Myanmar. It's an ASEAN policy that they're following by and large in relations to working to make the coup go away eventually. So it's there, but this is not the EU. It is not a federal or even confederate sort of organization. It is a shop for trying to create a better economic environment and a more coherent common foreign policy. What would be really good is that they had a code of conduct among themselves for the South China Sea that then they could present to China and say, sign on to this.
Well, I'll go ahead and hold my breath and wait for that to happen. As you may be aware, I am a code of conduct pessimist. I sort of think that it's the thing that will never happen. But I'm happy to be talked out of it by optimists. Before we sort of move into the next phase of this discussion, are the limitations of ASEAN part of what's driving this litany of new groupings that we're seeing? We're seeing AUKUS, we're seeing the Quad. We've got this U.S., Philippine, Japan trilateral happening next week, which I think we'll talk about in another podcast. Is it because ASEAN can't fulfill all of the hopes and dreams that we might have for it that we really have to look at some of these other groupings?
Well, ASEAN is now a security organization, full stop. So
is the Quad?
Not yet. No, it's not. India has been very clear it's not. But it is a way for countries to talk together about security issues. So, you know, it's at this inflection point we are now, and I'd like to talk to you about what alliances are, what they should commit each other to. Because when we were dealing with the Philippines back when South China Sea first started getting hotter and China started building their features, the concern in the U.S. was we can't let Philippines suck us into a confrontation with China by having Philippine ships somehow entice China into attacking them.
Yes. That was right? This is sort of the Henry Kissinger view of the world, right?
Exactly. So, as a result, Scarborough Shoal is now controlled by China, even though it's clearly within Philippines' EEZ, and there are all these features. So I guess the question for you then as a military guy is, what is the purpose of our alliances with the Philippines and Thailand, not to mention Japan, Korea, and Australia? Does it bring us more security, or is it just us providing security to those countries so we have influence, which is what, of course, China's.
No, it's a great question. And of course, all of these alliances were born in a different era. It was the Cold War, the U.S.-Soviet stare down. And we looked at these alliances as extremely important to our security. And I don't think that's really changed. Now, obviously, you know, some of the smaller countries get a lot out of an alliance with the United States. They get to sort of have the what we call extended deterrence of our nuclear umbrella over them. They have the advantages that come with, you know, receiving security assistance from the United States, although other countries get that too. And, you know, I mean, in the case of the U.S. and the Philippines, as we're talking about, we've got, you know, now we're beginning joint patrols with them in the South China Sea. And we're, you know, so all of these things are important to these countries. But frankly, with the rapid rise of China, it's hard to imagine U.S. security without its network of alliances and partnerships, but alliances in particular, because frankly, you know, China now has, at least by ship count, the largest navy in the world, and they're all extremely concentrated, whereas ours are spread out all over the globe. So, you know, we need to be able to, when we're out there counting red ships and blue ships, we need to be able to look at our allies and sort of see those, you know, their navies, their military forces as part of the overall security structure. And by the way, China knows this too, which is why it's constantly casting aspersion on countries that make alliances. They sort of look down their nose in their public propaganda at outsiders coming into their area, and it should be, you know, sort of Asia for the Asians, which means kind of in their view of the world, Asia that we can dominate from Beijing. So, you know, I am very much a proponent of alliances and partnerships, because I think, you know, the American people have not yet decided that we need to be arming up on the scale that China has been arming up. You know, we look at the world and we want to do other things. Understandably, the American people are interested in their own personal security first. They're interested in you know, their work security and their financial security and other things. And they look at it at international security as sort of an esoteric concept. And that's been, you know, this has been, you know, the way that democracies have approached these things for time immemorial. So it's very important, in my view, that when Xi Jinping wakes up every morning and looks out at his, you know, security ambitions, at his, you know, looks out at the East China Sea, the South China Sea, these other places, and sees, you know, the places where China might try to expand, that he see the network of alliances and partnerships as a deterrent, that he says, this is not a great day to pick the scab off that wound and start the bleeding. So, you know, I think just in terms of deterring bad behavior, alliances and partnerships are very important. And of course, God forbid, should we end up in an actual war, they may be existentially important. But Jim,
I just want to ask you a follow up on that. So the move from the hub and spoke so-called arrangement, where the U.S. is the belly button for all these alliances, to now the so-called lattice work, where third countries are making alliances with each other, with the U.S. either as another party or not, does that add to deterrence, or does it break up the whole system to make it less robust and reliable?
No, I think it's additive, because the alliances haven't gone away. The alliances are still the alliances. You know, if you ask people in Manila, you know, what are their security guarantees, the first thing they're going to point to is the Mutual Defense Treaty with the United States. They've got a burgeoning relationship with Japan, which should be helped into a new level by the summit next week. But, you know, that is not the same thing as an alliance. So from my perspective, we ought to keep encouraging these relationships. The whole idea behind the free and open Indo-Pacific is that this is a grouping of countries who have common interests and values, and we want to work together to make sure that, you know, access to the Indo-Pacific, to the global commons, to trade routes, to all of those things stay free and open. And of course, that's in contrast to Beijing's view, in which, you know, it's more of a sphere of influence where they are the ones ultimately who have control over those very same assets. So, you know, I think that, you know, the networking helps everyone. And also it sort of reduces the amount of sort of paternalistic overtones that may accompany the idea that the U.S. is the guarantor of everyone's security. And that breeds resentment in those countries, and it breeds resentment in the United States. And I don't think that's healthy for anyone. But I do want to turn this to just sort of, you know, getting to know us. And I want to start with the question to you, Jim. Why do you personally care about the Indo-Pacific?
Well, as I mentioned at the beginning, it's just too important an area not to care about. But my trip to being a diplomat, I started off after business school of joining a bank because I thought money's really important. Then I discovered making money just to make money from money is pretty boring for me. And after a few years, I said, you know what? I'll join the government, which was my midlife crisis instead of going for the Ferrari. And it was great. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the idea of solving problems in international relations. And most of the career was spent in the Pacific area. Well, Thailand, Indonesia, Australia, and working in a bunch of these countries from Washington for a couple of tours. And as I worked on these issues, it was everything you could hope for as a diplomat. There were economic issues, political issues, human rights issues, issues relating to how countries develop and get along with each other. And then, of course, the big kahuna, the rise of China, and how to keep them playing within the rules that have been established post-World War II, which, by the way, once they joined the rules, made them rich. And now they want to change the rules. So how do you get the new playground bully, or if not bully, new playground big guy to not push his weight around too much and leave room for all the other kids? And how about you, Ray? What brought this nice boy from California into him?
Well, it all started when I failed out of college. I was looking for, it was largely because I wasn't actually going to college, even though I was enrolled. And I realized that I needed to do something or else have to face the fact of going home and admitting to my father I was failing out of college. So instead, what I did instead was I joined the Air Force. And what they did was they sent me off to language school where I learned Vietnamese. And then they sent me to the Philippines. Now, remember, this was the end of the Cold War, so we were not in Vietnam. Now, we were very interested in Vietnam. And there were Soviet bombers flying out of Cam Ranh Bay in Vietnam. And that was the interest back then. And so I was in the Philippines for 3 years. And two important things happened in my life during those 3 years. The second of which was that there was a volcano that blew up called Mount Pinatubo, which caused an evacuation of Clark Air Base and eventually the end of the American base structure there. But the more important thing that happened to me was that I got married and my wife was from the Philippines. And so this is, this has given me a very personal tie to the Philippines that, of course, I've had for over three decades. And my military career continued to sort of bring me back to stations in Asia from Japan, of course, in Hawaii, where we have Indo-Pacific Command. And eventually brought me back to a real Vietnam assignment where I spent 3 years at the U.S. Embassy in my first diplomatic military assignment as an air attaché. And it was remarkable, of course, to realize that whereas my interest in Vietnam many, many years ago was entirely in their, sort of their place as an adversary, I was there to build a relationship. And it was exciting to go. It was exciting to finally get to use my Vietnamese language, even though I don't think I'm a natural linguist. But in talking to the Vietnamese government about, paths forward. And then, of course, I ended up down there in Australia with you. Somehow you survived that experience. I really feel like we did some great work down there together. I finally got out of my 35-year trek in the Air Force, which I had not planned for, but was great. I ended up here at Stanford University working on a project that was very focused on the South China Sea. And, with the idea that if you can bring transparency to gray zone operations, what we call gray zone, the gray zone where everything is opaque and deniable and not very clear, if you can turn on the lights in the gray zone, then maybe a sophisticated gray zone actor like China has to take into account that its actions have consequences. So that was kind of the journey that brought me to where I am today. I'm fascinated by the Indo-Pacific. I'm concerned about the Indo-Pacific, but I'm also excited about being able to talk about it with you and with a lot of the guests that we've got coming up. So thanks for doing this with me. And by the way, how did I actually talk you into this?
Oh, you have, sweet talker that you are.
Okay, so that will remain forever a mystery. As we look forward, Jim, we're gonna begin to schedule guests. We're gonna try to keep our guests current with things that are happening now. So, what we're planning for our next podcast to be a discussion about this upcoming summit in Washington D.C. between the President Biden and Prime Minister Kishida from Japan and President Marcos from the Philippines, and talk to some smart people about what does it mean that these three leaders are getting together and what can we expect out of this. And then going forward, we're going to sort of take the issues as they come. Whatever's interesting and hot from the news, you know, we're going to try to find the most interesting and smart people that we can on those topics and talk to them. And I'm excited about it. For our listeners, that's what you can look forward to. This deal with me and Jim talking to one another, it should be a blip on the screen. Mostly it'll be us interviewing other people. And so we want to thank you for tuning in this time. We want to invite you to tune in, in the coming days as we release more podcasts. Of course, what we have to do is we have to encourage you on your favorite streaming service to subscribe, to go to the part where lets you rate us and give us 5 stars and a glowing review with lots of superlatives. And if you don't like this podcast, then forget that I said that. So Jim, I look forward to talking to you soon. Let's talk about this U.S.-Japan-Philippines trilateral. Any final words?
I look forward to it, Ray. I look forward to a bunch of these podcasts where we get to answer questions from our listeners about why they should care. And if they don't care, maybe we can convince them otherwise, because I think you and I have a good argument for it being a really important region and something to pay attention to despite all the other stuff going on in our world.
Well said, sir. Well said. You are a good-looking man. For Jim Caruso, I'm Ray Powell. And this has been Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?